Iran's foreign minister stresses Tehran will never settle for a temporary or limited agreement to revive the JCPOA. A new poll shows a majority of Israelis believe that the regime is on the verge of economic, social, and political collapse. And the death toll from Hawaii wildfires rises to 96, with hundreds of people still missing amid growing anger over the response to the deadliest U.S. blaze in a century. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story this hour takes us right here to Iran. Iran says it is committed to resolving the 2015 deal through diplomacy, but it will not settle for a temporary or limited agreement. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, made the comment in a televised press conference. He added that Tehran has always wanted to return all parties to full compliance with the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Amir Abdullahian said that removing Washington's unilateral and unfair sanctions through diplomacy has always been on the government's agenda. On the unblocking of Iranian assets in South Korea and a prisoner swap with the U.S., he stressed that there are two independent and unrelated issues.
The Iranian funds in South Korea are unfrozen and given back to the Islamic Republic, which is our right. The prisoner swap is completely a humanitarian issue, and we do not consider any connection between that and the unfreezing of our assets.
He added that with the mediation of a third country, Tehran and Washington held separate meetings regarding the prisoner swap and the unfreezing of Iranian assets. The top diplomat said the assets were transferred from South Korean banks to a European bank. Billions of dollars was illegally frozen by Seoul for several years as a result of U.S. sanctions. Tehran strongly condemns Sunday's terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz, saying terrorists are trying to retaliate for the heavy blows Iran dealt to them. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said terrorists target innocent civilians out of anger over their humiliating defeats. Kanani also highlighted as decisive the role of the late Iranian commander, General Qasem Soleimani, in the fight against Daesh terrorists in Israel. Earlier, President Ebrahim Raisi ordered an immediate probe into the deadly terrorist attack, which left at least one person dead and several others wounded, some critically. A gunman opened fire at an entrance of the Shah Charak Shrine on Sunday. The assailant was arrested at the site. Security forces have also detained eight other suspects for the shooting. A political analyst, Hakim Issaqi Iberia, says the legacy of the late Iranian commander and the national hero in the fight against terror, General Qasem Soleimani, lives on despite his martyrdom.
So when we say martyr Qasem Soleimani, you know, religiously we believe that he is living. He's not dead. And we see that in the you know, in the continuation of his thought, in the continuation of the sincerity that, you know, the people who are following his footsteps, the security forces, and, you know, the people fighting terrorism on Iran's behalf, and in the region, you know, in the resistance front, we see the continuation of his life, actually, that, you know, he's living, he's not dead. Of course, I was saying that, you know, this has been an ongoing fight, that every once in a while we hear news of, you know, plots that have been found out and, you know, haven't been able to actually actualize. We have had several of those sort of plots in the last couple of months, you know, between the time of the last Shah Charak terrorist attack and today. And sometimes that doesn't get as much news coverage as, you know, it should.
Well, in Israel, months of violent protests against a highly controversial judicial overhaul plan have led to a severe internal crisis. A new poll shows the majority of Israelis believe that the regime is on the brink of an economic, social, and political collapse. Now, the poll conducted by an Israeli institute suggests that over 58% of people believe that the regime has entered a state of emergency. This following last month's passage of a bill that would see the highest court stripped of most of its powers. Now, the poll also shows that the majority of Israelis have lost faith in the future, with nearly one-third of them considering leaving the occupied territories. The planned judicial overhaul, which was proposed in January, has sparked massive protests and criticism, both at home and abroad. Well, Lebanon is marking the 17th anniversary of Hezbollah's victory over Israeli forces in the 33-day war. The Tel Aviv regime's air and ground invasion triggered a strong response by the resistance movement. Well, the war ended following a UN-brokered ceasefire that not only put an end to a confrontation between the Israeli army and the resistance forces, but also ushered in a new era for Hezbollah's achievements. Our correspondent in southern Lebanon, Mariam Saleh, explains.
That was the time when the Israelis basically were not only defeated, they did not accomplish any of their objectives during that time. And August 14th, you saw hundreds, maybe thousands of people who were from South Lebanon. They came back to their homes, even on the same day, just an hour after the ceasefire, on August 14th at 8 a.m., when the Israeli hostilities stopped. And then the Israelis were still pulling up their tanks from some areas at the border. We had thousands of people packed up, ready to return to their destroyed homes, despite the fact that there were no roads, there were no bridges. People were stopping their cars, walking for long distances, or waiting for in their cars for hours until there was some sort of a road that the army had opened in order for them to return. We saw these images with our own eyes. So therefore, this did not just signal the end of a war or the end of a confrontation between the Islamic resistance, the Hezbollah, and the Israeli army, which is something that people before the year 2000 were used to. They were used to this continuous confrontation. However, what we saw was actually a new phase. The Israelis, in addition to not accomplishing any of their objectives, they were not able to defeat Hezbollah. Hezbollah's arms are still intact. Hezbollah's power is still intact. They are gaining strength, gaining momentum. Sayyid Nasrallah has said on and on that they have more than 10,000 rockets. He said this after the year 2006, so now it might be even more than maybe tens of thousands of rockets, perhaps. So we have that gaining strength for the resistance, and at the same time, you have more support for Hezbollah.
Well, Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip were left with seriously contaminated water due to years of Israeli blockade and multiple military attacks. Ashraf Shannon brings us more.
Groundwater pollution has reached an alarming level in the Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants, posing grave risks for Gazans. Israel has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewage systems and targeted them during wars. Water pollution poses serious health risks throughout the tiny coastal sliver.
The Israeli continuous blockade has severe implications on the situation of water in Gaza. 97% of the Gaza aquifer water is polluted due to the destruction happened on the last offensives that we witnessed in Gaza Strip.
More than 2 million Gazans are forced to buy filtered water in order to cook or drink. Tap water in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. People only use it for house cleaning and doing the laundry.
Tap water is not suitable for drinking, and I think it's not even good for animals to drink. Tap water makes us sick, and we only use it to wash our clothes and to clean the house. My family spends a lot of money to buy filtered water. We only use filtered water to cook and drink.
Inhumane Israeli practices have taken their toll on the coastal sliver's drinking water. Water contamination levels are at least 3 times higher than the standards of the World Health Organization for safe drinking water. The consumption of contaminated water at levels over international safety standards can cause potentially life-threatening diseases.
Years of Israeli siege and multiple wars since 2008 have devastated Gaza's water infrastructure and led to increasing levels of pollution in drinking water supplies. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
Moving now to Afghanistan, where a blast has rocked a hotel in the southeastern province of Khost. Local media says at least three people have been killed and seven others injured. So far, there's no claim of responsibility. We're earlier joined by Rahmatullah Bakhban, who gave us more details.
An explosion took place in a hotel southeastern host of Afghanistan. The hotel is said to be protected by Waziristani displaced people or Waziristani refugees and host province local people. Local reporters say that the victims are taken to the hospital and the Taliban forces have taken full control of the area and have a heavy presence here. However, it's not clear that who or what is behind the blast. The motive or nature of the attack is not announced yet as well. But there are some rumors, especially by Pakistani media or reporters, that it is hit by Pakistani rocket, because in that hotel PCP members were located, but it's not officially announced any of that, either the Taliban in Afghanistan or Pakistani government.
Moving on to other news, turning to the United States, where the death toll from the wildfires in Hawaii has risen to 96 amid growing anger over the response to the deadliest U.S. blaze in 100 years. Hawaiian authorities say the number of fatalities will increase further as hundreds of people are still unaccounted for. The fire has damaged or destroyed more than 2,200 structures in the hardest hit town of Lahaina. It has also left thousands homeless. Officials have launched an investigation into the handling of the fire, as residents are complaining that there were no warnings. Hawaii Congresswoman Jill Tokuda says officials had underestimated the danger of the devastating fire. The blaze has been described as the worst natural disaster in the island's history. The UK is once again the scene of another strike action, this time by junior doctors who are locked in disputes with the government over pay. The doctors are calling for a 35% rise in their wages, but the government has only proposed one-fourth of that amount, making dismal the prospects of finding a resolution to the crisis.
The United Kingdom is hit with yet another strike action as junior doctors have launched a new walkout amid continued disputes with the government over pay and working conditions. The four-day strike began on Friday and continues until Tuesday. It includes actions by doctors just days into the medical practice. Doctors say their walkout has reached its tipping point due to the government's failure to deliver on its promises. The junior doctors demand a 35% rise, but the government says that is unrealistic and not negotiable. It is proposing a fourth of what junior doctors are asking for. The action is set to impact tens of millions of people receiving services from the National Health Service or NHS. The walkout could push only the number of appointments cancelled due to the NHS strikes past 1 million.
Pay us or lose us!
Save our NHS!
Save our NHS!
NHS officials have warned of massive disruptions as a result of the strike action taken by the junior doctors.
This latest round of junior doctors' strikes will again significantly disrupt services for patients. The additional changes this time is that organizations are unable to use agency workers to cover staff out on a strike. It is also a period of time where NHS staff often take annual leave, so there are already gaps in the workplace.
The comments by Dr. Powis comes as the number of people on waiting lists for treatment has surged to a record 7.6 million. In the past months, UK nurses, ambulance staff, and other medical workers have all joined the industrial action across the NHS, mounting more pressure on the government to address the economic woes and financial stress on the public health service workers.
Well, the UK has been hit by similar actions by workers from other public and private sectors over the past year, at a time when Britain is dealing with issues such as housing, soaring food prices, and chronic energy shortages. One wonders if the government of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak will be able to survive.
The four-day stoppage by junior doctors, to come as the British Medical Association, or BMA, which represents strikers, says the take-home pay of junior doctors has plunged by 26% in the last 15 years. BMA says it will continue to campaign for better pays for its members after branding the public sector pay rise announced by the government in July as insufficient. UK Health Minister Steve Barclay has remained defiant to the junior doctors' request for increased pay. Barclay insists that the pay increase is sufficient and has urged the BMA to end its strikes immediately. Barclay says the pay rise of 6% announced by the government is final. This comes as Britain has been hit hard by similar such action for the past year, with NHS staff being among the main government employees calling for higher wages and better working conditions. The most recent one was a strike staged by senior doctors on July 20 and 21. The British Medical Association said senior doctors will stage another two-day walkout on August 24th and 25th, with the industrial action expected to put the country's National Health Service under more strain. The back-to-back walkouts have already taken their toll on the country's healthcare system, prompting fears for patients' safety. Not only that, the unprecedented cost of living crisis in the UK has already impacted the Brits hard. Just to mention a few examples, an umbrella group has warned that London's housing crisis is becoming unmanageable, as 1 in 50 Londoners are now living in temporary accommodation. The group has urged the government to help low-income families. In the case of food prices, the cost of some basic items such as cheese, butter and bread has soared to more than 30% in the last 2 years, forcing poorer households to make desperate choices between keeping up with their bill payment or putting food on the table. But those are just tip of the iceberg, as the government of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is dealing with a huge economic paralysis. From raising of interest rates to curb inflation and its subsequent impact on the UK households, to a large portion of the British population being at a breaking point in dealing with their economic situation, it is not clear what lies ahead in the future for the Brits. Maybe a change in government economic policies can act as a short-term remedy to bring an end to the crisis in the UK.
And with that brings us to the end of this At Worldless edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Economic divide.
The BRICS summit will be held on August 22 through 24, and boy, are there important topics to cover during this most important summit. From de-dollarization to new payment systems to replacing the SWIFT system. Some of these topics were covered in the Africa Summit, actually, that was held in Russia in St. Petersburg. It emphasized the important role of African countries in the world, especially in the BRICS format. Hi, I'm Kavitavli. Welcome to Economic Divide. Some of the highlights coming up: BRICS payment system. We're going to look at that, how SWIFT will be replaced, non-Western financial system, along with de-dollarization, all to happen under the BRICS payment system. Next up, we take a look at Russia's Forex in terms of the reserves that they had. U.S. and EU seizure of funds, well, that was seen as a political weapon exercised by the U.S. for countries that did not conform to the U.S. foreign policy. And then we take a look at what has been said quite a bit these days, New World Order. The collapse of the unipolar world means that, and a multipolar world with Africa and new BRICS membership, in which 19 African countries have applied for membership.
July 2023, Russia hosted a summit with African nations in St. Petersburg. Scores of African leaders and senior officials visited the country. 49 nations out of the continent's 54 were represented in St. Petersburg. Russia and African states also stressed the goal of working together to counter manifestations of neo-colonial policies that aim to undermine the sovereignty of states. The U.S. is widely believed to have 29 military bases in 15 countries in the African continent, while France continues to maintain its presence in 10 states. Revived business and trade ties with Africa has put the continent into focus, with many claiming the continent could play a vital and critical role in the emerging world order.
Time now for our look at the social media posts along with website entries. First up, we're going to take a look at a tweet that was posted, but this is basically the slogan of BRICS, which it included Africa in it, and it said partnership for mutually accelerated growth, sustainable development, and inclusive multilateralism. So that shows what BRICS is all about. Next, we went to YouTube and we looked at the channel called the Rich Dad Channel. Is the name of it, with host John McGregor. And this particular episode said, will a new currency replace the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency?
Hey, everyone. Loaded show today. A lot to cover in a short period of time. Today, I first want to discuss this new currency that's being talked about that, if implemented, could destroy the U.S. economic dominance as the world's number one reserve currency. Folks, this is a big story.
Now we move on to a website. It said BRICS payment system will replace SWIFT in new non-Western world. Went on to say the continent will be part of a multipolar world with completely new economic relations. That was something that, in this particular case, the website being RT, Igor Morozov said and relayed to that channel. Next up, a comment by the name of Coral Koshak. Africa is joining Russia, China, and BRICS in establishing a multipolar, multilateral, sovereign New World Order, replacing the racist, fascist, old world order of the hegemon West. Adding Russia and China offer the last chance for a new world order promoting world peace through the establishment of a multipolar, multilateral, sovereign community of nations. All right, lots of multipolar terminology there. Hopefully we expand on that and open that up for you in terms of its definition. Our first segment of our Q&A, however, is up. Let me introduce our guest. We have Julio Gambina, who joins us. Julio Gambina is an Argentinian economist and investigative journalist. Julio Gambina, welcome to Economic Divide. All right, when we take a look at the announcements by the Africa Summit that was made in that was held in Russia in St. Petersburg, one of them is that the BRICS payment system will be replaced. Will replace that as the SWIFT payment system, and they termed that as a new non-Western world. That's how in that space this is going to happen. Is that really going to happen? And what are the challenges that are preventing that from happening now?
It is premature to anticipate the evolution of the measures in response to the unilateral sanctions ordered by the United States. It is true that the times for institutional developments in the economy and finance that put into question the hegemony of the emerging world order after the Second World War accelerated, especially the role of the dollar, international organizations, and the other instruments of globalization deployed in recent 40 years and cut in recent years due to United States sanctions.
Thank you for that. Let me introduce our next guest for this segment of our Q&A. Vincius Rodriguez Vieira joins us. He's an associate professor of economics at FAAT in Sao Paulo. Vincius, welcome to Economic Divide. You know, when you take a look at what the United States and the EU did through their sanctions, which ultimately ended up with the seizure of Russia's forex reserves, which included dollars also and gold, many countries around the world realize that it's, you know, the U.S. using the dollar as a political weapon through sanctions and obviously a financial pressure that it wants to exert along with a message to different countries of the world, which many say that don't bend to U.S. foreign policy. Is this one of the reasons, if not the main reason, that countries are now saying we need to de-dollarize and remove dollar from their trades?
Certainly, after the seizure of the Russian assets by the West, particularly by the United States, countries like Saudi Arabia plus BRICS members, regional powers in general, they started considering moving away their reserves, their assets from U.S. banks and from U.S. dollar-denominated assets apart from euro-denominated assets, because they realized that what happened with Russia may happen with them. Here, I would like to highlight that I'm not endorsing any position on Russia about the war, but just trying to make a very cold analysis to highlight the fact that countries in the future, for any reason that the United States or European Union may be aware of, may want, they may end up being subject to the same types of sanctions.
It's time now for the infinite section of the program. First up, we take a look at Russia's economy and how it's doing. The entry went on to say that Russia has become Europe's biggest economy. Really? Is that true? Is that accurate? That's right. I had to do a double take because that is true. The country's GDP is outperforming that of Germany. Basically, what we are looking at in this respect, our perspective, is that if Russia's economy is growing, and at this rate, then what does that say about the U.S. sanctions, or the European sanctions for that matter? Well, you can only draw the conclusion that it shows its inefficiency and how other countries are defying them. So much for sanctions. Next up, a big deal in the credit world when it comes to the country, the one in focus here, the U.S., where the credit rating agency, Fitch, has downgraded the U.S., and therefore the U.S. has lost its top rating. Basically, some of the reasons: fiscal deterioration, recession fears, debt burden, and the erosion of governance. Those were some of the reasons given. Our take, any surprise? With a debt of over $33 trillion, the U.S. debt to GDP ratio is 100.1%. That's 2.5 times higher than the AAA rated country's median of 39.3%, if you can believe that. All right, next up, this entry is an interesting one, and we found it unique in terms of the theme that it has. The title, Hijabi. That's right. It said, "Move over Barbie, Hijabi is back," to celebrate Muslim fashion and culture. Of course, this has a serious undertone to it. And really got to hand it to this young Nigerian woman who noticed the lack of modest fashion and hijabs for dolls online. Therefore, she decided to create her own. And this is her. Here she is, a creative entrepreneur to have seen how Muslim gear was actually underrepresented. So she went and did what she did. Kudos to her. All right, time now for a special investigation. Niger's uranium is our focus. How dependent is France on Niger's uranium? We're going to be looking at this. We've started the investigation. We're a natural resource obviously essential to the operation of French nuclear power plants. Guess what? It's uranium that's mined in Niger. And that has been exploited for over four decades by the French nuclear fuel cycle group by the name of Orano, formerly Areva.
Health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Section of the program. There have been lots of activity when it comes to BRICS nations, lots of news. I'm sure you'll agree. Well, by default, one of the issues is going to be de-dollarization, which is a consequence, at least when it comes to BRICS. But are these just myths or realities? That's what we want to find out in this section of our program. All right, let's get started. First up, we're going to take a look at something that happened under the umbrella of the New World Order, anti-Russia, U.S., EU sanctions. They confiscated Russian assets. The U.S. Treasury had a big part of that. Gold and foreign exchange reserves were confiscated to the amount of $302.5 billion was the value of that. Next up, another factor that has happened is the U.S. dollar weaponization, as I said, a consequence. Countries panicked because the U.S. dollar was being weaponized against them, possibly. So they went ahead and converted their foreign reserves, and two of the options they had, yuan and gold, is what they converted their assets into. To continue with the trend of de-dollarization, national currencies have been now used in bilateral trade. Payment systems and cards integration also have been put in place. And financial messaging system accommodates that in order for the de-dollarization to continue. Then we have de-dollarization in the BRICS countries. Okay, so there's what's called a BRICS Pay, which was introduced years ago. You have a single payment system in order to make sure that dollar is not used. And then you have what's called this cloud platform, where it connects the national payment systems in order for that to happen, along with the common currency, which was the last one. Now, SWIFT replacement is a big one. Russia, China, and Iran, they each have their own payment systems, as you can see over here. BRICS has said it's going to introduce that in 6 months, and everybody's looking forward to see whether that is going to be discussed, which I'm sure it will be, in the upcoming BRICS summit. And after we look at what has happened over here, as you can see, I've left these on the wall for you in order for you to review them to make sure that you're not missing something, because there's a whole lot of information here, you know, from SWIFT replacement to BRICS de-dollarization and the de-dollarization trend that we talked about in the beginning, and how the U.S. dollar was weaponized along with the anti-Russia, U.S. and EU sanctions. Okay? Now let's see whether BRICS has something to stand on. This is the BRICS stats, of which 23% is the share of the global economy of BRICS countries. And that's a lot when you consider it's the entire world. And then 25% share of global investment. A quarter of global investment happens from BRICS countries. Think about that. Then the share of global trade in goods, 18%. And then the big one, wait for it, it's coming up. And here it is, 33.4% of the global GDP, which adds up to $26.01 trillion. That's how much the share of the global GDP BRICS countries has. So BRICS does have something to stand on, which obviously is going to go through with things like de-dollarization. All right. Before we get to our guest, let me introduce Mahdi. Mahdi is going to join us now to tell us more about what's going to be coming up in his section, the quick take section. All right, Mahdi, what do you have coming up for us?
Thanks, Gove. It was really difficult to pick the important ones, but the introduction of a common currency is one of them, which may or may not happen in the upcoming summit in South Africa.
All right, great. Thank you so much for that. All right, let's get our guests back into the picture and see what they think about some of these issues we've been covering. We have Julia Gambina rejoining us, Argentinian economist and investigative journalist. Julia Gambina, welcome back. When you take a look at what's called the unipolar world, it is said that it's collapsing and a multipolar world is formed along with the participation of Africa, which is not mentioned as much. Last year alone, you had 19 African countries that applied for BRICS membership because they want a completely new economic relationship as opposed to the West. Is this what we're looking at when we mention the world, a new world order, at least part of it?
Well, what is happening is a disarmament of globalization deployed for four decades between the 80s, 90s and recent years. The disorder promoted by the unilateral sanctions of the United States and its global partners, especially Europe, is motivating new frameworks of international relations that intervene in the reorganization of the world system.
All right, this reorganization that he's talking about is important here. We have discussed that throughout the program in one way or another. Let me bring in Vinicius Rodriguez Vieira, who rejoins us. Vinicius, welcome back. We're looking at the African participation when it comes to this new economic relations that they want to have within the BRICS context, because they don't want to deal with the Western financial system as much. And, of course, the unipolar world, how it's collapsing, along with the multipolar world, which is being promoted through BRICS. How do you think this is all going to work out? Is this what we're looking at overall in terms of a new world order?
I think we are not yet there. There's still a long way until we rebuild an alternative world order in which there would be far more participation from the global south, particularly from the democracies of the global south, like Brazil, South Africa are good examples. In the case of Africa, I think a definitely move towards a real multipolar world in which Africa is incorporated as an independent voice in world politics will be the invitation by President Lula when Brazil will have the G20 next year to the meeting here in Rio de Janeiro. The African Union will be invited to join G20 as a member, like the European Union is of G20. Therefore, that would be a very strong step towards a true multipolar world, because it's ridiculous to think that a large continent like Africa has just one representative in such an important forum like the G20, namely South Africa.
BRICS is one of those alternative routes to Western hegemony. The group is comprised of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. But currently, a host of other nations are vying to join the club. Apart from Iran, Argentina, and Saudi Arabia, nearly 20 African nations have applied to become a BRICS member or are contemplating to do so. Russia, China, and Brazil have turned to greater use of non-dollar currencies in their cross-border transactions. Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates are actively exploring dollar alternatives, and central banks have sought to shift more of their currency reserves away from the dollar and into gold. Furthermore, the Asian Clearing Union, ACU, a nine-member group of central banks, including those of India, Pakistan, and Iran, has decided to launch a new cross-border financial messaging system in June as an alternative to SWIFT.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matti Apossian. BRICS 7 could be the quickest route to a multipolar world. The upcoming BRICS summit is set to establish a criteria for expansion into the bloc. Why will it be called BRICS 7 and not BRICS? Because two additional members may officially join and bring the total number of members from the current five to seven. The introduction of the BRICS 7 would allow the bloc to introduce two additional members to grow its GDP and economic influence. Subsequently, these two factors could completely shift the geopolitical power balance. And which two countries, may you ask? Prior to the summit, the talk was that Saudi Arabia and Indonesia were in the running, which could add another $2 trillion to BRICS GDP. Here are the BRICS members' GDP figures and the ones that have applied for membership. If you add the GDP figures, the grand total you would get would be $35.15 trillion. Here's why the end of the dollar dominance is here. For those non-believers, India has convinced 22 countries to trade in rupee and to ditch US dollar. BRICS members, India, China and Russia, are convincing other developing countries to trade in their respective native currencies and not the US dollar. Still think that is not enough to challenge the US dollar and its dominance? Maybe the new BRICS currency will do that. Highly anticipated to be unveiled in the upcoming BRICS summit, although there are reports that indicate it may not happen at this summit. Nevertheless, as the US dollar loses value due to growing regulations, inflation, and the rise of BRICS, a new global currency can start making its push to the top. And this currency will be backed by gold. As such, the BRICS nations aim to provide a tangible and stable backing, diverging from the credit-based nature of the US dollar. And the engine behind BRICS that will power countries with loans and finances, especially for infrastructure projects, is the New Development Bank. So that does it for this section of the program.
The United States and Europe are digressing in the world standing, at least in terms of their economic standing. They are not in the lead when it comes to the revenue generation compared to the new BRICS formation. Although it will take a bit of time for BRICS to dismantle, the destructive role in some sense of the West and the U.S. in the way that their economies actually went after developed nations, let's say, such as the Islamic Republic, well, you're going to see that BRICS is going to be successful because they have a larger share when it comes to the world GDP, something that we covered. But how fast this is going to happen, I believe the BRICS upcoming BRICS summit will determine the time frame of how all those things will happen and move forward with it. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for tuning in. When we cover Tagway and the team, it's goodbye until the next Economic Divide.
The ocean of dua.
Al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam ziyaratan minni wa niyabatan an walidayya.
Why did you leave us to fend for ourselves?
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarisi, and in this edition of The Ocean of Dua, we are trying to discuss and talk about the different aspects of Ziyarat Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, Ziyarat al-Ashura. So stay with us.
فَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ أُمَّتَانْ أَسَّسَتْ أَسَاسَ الظُّلْمِ وَالْجَارِ عَلَيْكُمْ أَهْلَ الْبَيْتِ وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ أُمَّتَانْ عن مقامكم وأزالتكم عن مراتبكم التي رتبكم الله فيها.
Throughout the previous programs, dear listeners, we concluded that since in the different verses of the Holy Quran, and of course the traditions reflected both in Shi'i and Sunni sources, there are many cases of la'an specifically related to the Holy Prophet of Islam, expressing his la'an on the people like the ones who tormented his household, or the one who torments his neighbor, etc. Expressing la'an is not prohibited. Now, some Muslims opine that we are only allowed to do la'an in a general way. That is, we cannot curse a particular person whom we determine and decipher to be among those who, according to the teachings of Islam, deserve to be cursed. In the book titled as The Sacred Effusion, the commentary on Ziyarat Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, or the so-called Ziyarat al-Ashura, available at al-islam.org, it's mentioned that the reality is quite contrary, because not only do we have proofs that establish the permissibility of la'an on specific people, we have many traditions where some of the signposts of the guidance clearly express their la'an on specific people, and sometimes by names. Of course, we do not negate that expressing la'an in small instances due to personal grudges or interests is abhorred and maybe forbidden, and sometimes dangerous as well. And nor do we encourage one to invoke la'an on those identities and states one does not know properly and completely. However, that does not mean that we restrict la'an to the general invocation of curse.
When people ask, I'm confused about which school is right or which madhab is right, go to Karbala. Look at Karbala, it clarifies it instantaneously. Anybody says, I'm confused, say, please go to Karbala and tell me what happened, why it happened, and what does it have to do with your religion. You will see it completely exemplifies, it clarifies, it takes all the blurs out instantaneously. SubhanAllah, that's the miracle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's main foundation of morality is, do not allow tyranny. Do not allow evil doing. Do not allow indecency. Why is Imam like this? Because he knows Allah. He appreciates Him. He understands His dimensions. That's why we must love them so much. We must love them so much that don't let anybody else take us away from them. There should be no room in our thoughts. No matter who we admire in this world, no matter how great a person we look at, never move the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt out of the center of the heart. Never. They will know that their Khalifa lied to them because he told them they don't pray. And if they see them praying on the battlefield, their hearts will change. So stop them from praying. Imagine how evil these people were. That's how much lies they had. And you cannot eradicate this lie at the level that we're talking about unless you give your blood for the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
The divine scholar Mullah Muhammad al-Naraqi writes in his ethical masterpiece, Jami' al-Sa'adat, that the truth is that cursing a specific person who is known to have the attribute of willful disbelief or wrongdoing is permissible. And what has been said about its impermissibility, to the exception of one about whom there is religious evidence, such as the Pharaoh and Abu Jahl, due to the possibility
that whosoever possesses these attributes may abandon them and die the death of a believer or in the state of penitence and in a station of close to the Almighty Allah's mercy and not distant from Him is a statement which should be ignored and not narrated. He continues and explains that we have comprehended from the speech of Allah the Almighty and His Messenger and the statements of the infallible Imams, the permissibility of attributing the same to a specific person. And of course, it is clear that it is impermissible to attribute disbelief and volitional disobedience to someone without proper investigation. Then the divine scholar Naraqi states the different cases that the curse has been expressed by the Holy Prophet. The Holy Prophet ﷺ has said, "May Allah curse the liar even if he is joking." And in response to Abu Sufyan's 1,000 verses of poetry in ridicule of him, the Holy Prophet ﷺ has said, "O Allah, curse him on every letter that he utters with 1,000 curses." And he moves on to say that it is narrated that during the state of Qunut, of Amir al-Mu'mineen's obligatory prayers, he would invoke curses on Muawiyah and of course some others. Despite being the most forbearing of the people and most forgiving to whosoever does evil to him, if he would not consider his invocation of curses as being among the acts of divine obedience, he would not have chosen its place to be the obligatory prayers. So the fact that the expressing of La'an has been recorded in the Qunut of these obligatory prayers of Imam Ali alayhi salam can be taken as a proof that it is not prohibited at all. And of course, there is no problem with invoking La'an on a specific person. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
الذي صنعت من الرمح منبرا ظمآن والزمان بعينيك ممطرا نعم الأمير أنت حسين وقدوتي ساروا إليك قلبي وعقلي ودمعتي يا محيي الكرامة تبكيك كل عين لبيك يا إمامي لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين لبيك يا حسين لبيك يا حسين.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.